Welcome to Sound Philosophy, a podcast exploring philosophical and interpretive issues in the history of popular music and sometimes in the history of philosophy itself. This episode continues my conversation with Eric Taxier over Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, this time dealing with Book 2, Chapters 1 and 2. Thank you for joining us. Enjoy. I'm joined once again by Eric Taxier, and today we are beginning Book 2 of the Nicomachean Ethics. We're going to look at the first two chapters, and Eric was just pointing out to me that there's a kind of cyclical aspect, even though probably Aristotle didn't put these chapters, these parts into books. That was probably done by a later editor, and that's what most scholars seem to think. There still is a kind of format, at least for these first two books, that we start in this kind of very general way of let's just get the basic landscape under control. What are the big concepts that need to be touched on without really broaching them in any detailed way? And then, as hopefully you recall, in Book 1 we got to Chapter 7, and that's where everything kind of came into focus, and where he was presenting, he wasn't just clearing space anymore, but rather placing something within that cleared space. And I think we're going to find a similar trajectory in this book. The space that's being cleared here has to do with virtue and with action in order to set up his doctrine of the mean. I think that's going to be the centerpiece of Book 2. I imagine we'll come to agree that that's the case.
Yeah, sort of the analogy to the capital F function argument from the first book.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly what I was thinking. So, you know, in one sense, what Chapter 1 of Book 2 does, just to really be very schematic for a sense, is it sets up the idea, it reinforces an idea that's already been broached in Chapter 13 of Book 1, which is that there are two types of excellences or virtues. There's the excellence of thought, and there's the excellence of character. And I should have done them in the reverse order, because that's the order that he's going to explore them. Ethics of virtues of character, and then virtues of thought. And that'll be over the course, not just of Book 2, but of the next several books. And then Chapter 2 of Book 2 presents a glimpse of, not a fully worked out yet version of, but a glimpse of his theory of action, of how we understand action. What is it that's involved in action? All right, so let's start with Chapter 1. Chapter 1 starts, like I said, basically with a recapitulation, that there are two types of excellences or virtues. They are twofold. On the one hand, there's excellence of thought, and on the other, excellence of character. And he says that excellence of thought develops chiefly through teaching, and therefore it requires experience and time. But excellence of character results from habit, whence it has acquired its name, which is a slight modification of the word ethos, which is the word for habit. So he's saying that ethike, ethics, comes from ethos, which is pretty Heideggerian. Like, you know, in some ways, you could see where Heidegger got his interest in etymology. Or, you know, I mean, ultimately, this comes from Plato, right? Plato spends, is it the Cratylus? Yes, the Cratylus. In the Cratylus, Plato spends some time talking about etymology, basically, and the idea that the reason that we as a species have derived certain words from other words is because we see some kind of relationship there, and then by tracing etymology, you're actually doing more than just linguistic or
it's not just a silly game that you're playing.
Philology was the word I was looking for. You're doing more than philological work. You're doing actual philosophical work, right? Mm-hmm. All right, so let's start with just this, right? So he says that excellence of character comes from habit, and excellence of thought comes from teaching, which is why it requires experience and time. In one sense, that's reinforcing something he said earlier, the experience and time thing, where he says that we can't really expect children to really be virtuous. When we praise them for their virtues, it's really praising them for how they're developing, not what they've fully developed, right? And so, to some extent, certain things take experience and time. But, I mean, so do virtues of character, right? I mean, you don't act bravely one time and say to yourself, well, I've got it now. I'm all good, right? The whole point is that, as he's going to point out here in a moment, is that we learn courage by doing courageous things over and over again, being habituated. So that requires time too. So why is he modifying the idea of excellence of thought with it requires experience and time and not excellence of character?
Yeah, it seems like we're learning in both cases. The part that has reason is learning, and then the part that sort of listens to reason is also learning. And then the distinction here, at best, it seems like, and this is the very, very beginning of the first chapter of this book, so, you know, he admits later that he's being kind of general. But if we're trying to find a distinction at this point, there's this kind of gesture toward an abstraction in the case of virtues of thought versus, you know, the sort of regular use of our potential, I guess, in the case of virtues of character. Mm. So that's the best I can do. Basically, it's almost like learning math or something, right? Where you're we're both teachers and we're sort of talking about STEM stuff earlier, but I'm imagining maybe there's something almost STEM-like about the virtues of thought, right? But that there are these like rules or ideas that we then, once we've learned them, whereas there's something else, that some other process that's taking place with learning virtues of character.
I mean, I think ultimately you're right. But it doesn't mean that I totally agree with Aristotle here, right? Mm-hmm. Let me lay it out. First of all, let's clarify what you were just saying, and I want to make it super clear. Virtues of thought, you're absolutely right. They derive from teaching, because he's talking primarily about abstract theoretical sciences, including things like geometry and math and so on. Now, you could say, well, wait a minute, we can apply geometry. Isn't that what a carpenter does, or an architect? That's applied geometry in various ways, right? They're figuring out what shape is going to not succumb to gravity and all the rest of it. But for him, he seems to think of that as on a lower platform, in a way, that the science as such for geometry is theoretical science. Applied geometry is exactly that. It's applied geometry, right? And therefore is a derivation of it. It's not the thought in the strong sense. Now, that's important for us, because as he says in a way, I'm getting ahead of myself, but because it's so early in chapter two, I think we might as well approach it now since I've brought it up. He says in the opening, he's reminding us that the thing that he can do best is provide a kind of sketch, right? That he can't give you all the details, and we'll go into more detail about why that is when we get to chapter two. But he's basically saying that ethics isn't about the theoretical, it's about the practical, it's about putting things into act, doing things, right? But isn't there a theoretical aspect to ethics? I mean, by learning what is ethically correct, aren't we learning two things? What is good? Whatever that might be, like how the good works, and also what is human, because obviously ethics here applies to us. He's not talking about the ethics of white-tailed deer or something like that, or how they should behave. So aren't we learning some theoretical, abstract things in learning ethics?
Yeah, maybe he's cheating a little bit when he says that this book at least the course that he's teaching with these ideas is mainly for adults or young adults, right? That people who have already basically gotten that lesson, they've already sort of learned the important principles in some way through the processes that he's describing. Yeah.
But how does that address the question that I brought up?
Oh, well, I'm more just concerned, I guess, here with the distinction here between the virtues of thought and the virtues of character. And and he seems to be presupposing that most of the people that he's teaching this stuff to, the sort of theory of ethics, I guess, if that's what you were aiming at,
What I'm aiming at is ultimately that, but I don't think he's trying to teach that here. Do you feel like he's trying to teach a theory of ethics here?
I think there's
theory,
yeah.
But is he trying to teach a theoretical approach to ethics?
Well, he's certainly laying out his ideas in such a way that we can deduce a theory beneath it, I think.
Okay.
And it's in a pretty condensed format. And the people that he's teaching it to, the sort of context.
Not to quibble, but is deduce really the word you mean?
Well, figure out whatever he's talking about, right?
Yeah, infer, right?
I mean, okay.
Because deduce would mean that it follows necessarily from. And unless there's some surprises coming that I don't remember from earlier readings of this, I don't think he ever gives us any reason to think that we can firmly establish based on what he's written in underlying theory. We'd have to infer it, right?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be a pain in the ass.
Well, to identify some sort of consistency of thought that that we can point to a principle somewhere beneath it. Whether we do it in a sort of strong way where we take ideas that he's laid out and say these can only be true if, and then that would be, I guess, the deduction, right? But we can think of it as inference if you like. But the general idea anyway is that he has this relatively compressed, I would say, partly theoretical, you know, ethical treatise. It's not just a manual for action,
right.
And then he's delivering it to people who, in his mind anyway, have already basically made it through some of the hard work that goes into developing their ethical being, right? So that's all I was sort of drawing attention to. He's kind of cheating a little bit where he is kind of doing some of that theoretical work or helping us sort of arrive at these principles about ethics after we have already reached a point where we're prepared to do so, it's almost like just one little step further that he's pushing his readership.
Yeah, I think ultimately, I don't think he would disagree with what we're saying here, that any theoretical study will have some practical application, and any practical study will have some theoretical implications. I think that he would agree with that. It's just a matter of again, we can think of this in relation to Telos, right? That again, he's concerned with what is the ultimate project here. And for him, everything to do with geometry, whether it's carpentry or architecture or literally studying geometry, all of that is in service of the theoretical understanding, right? That ultimately what's important for him, we don't have to agree with this, but for him it seems what's important is the truth of it, the episteme, the truth of it, the solid, firm knowledge. Whereas with ethics, even though there may be some episteme involved, there certainly are principles involved, and we're going to come back to that issue of principles, and he uses the term logos all the time, which of course means principles and logic and a lot of other things, reason. But the primary concern for him, for ethics, is in action. And I wonder if that partly has to do with the idea that ethics has to do with us in the realm of becoming. And that's why there is no manual as such, because it's not unchanging like that. There are certain things that perhaps are exceptionless, but right, like you could say, we've used this example before, but you could say, well, it's always right to give something back to people that you've borrowed it from. But then the guy comes and he says, hey, do you have my axe? I really want to go kill my wife. And you don't give it back to him. That, in that case, that's an exception to that rule, right? But as Aristotle will later say, there's never an exception to certain rules. So there are certain ethical principles that we could think of as actual principles that don't have exceptions. Like, for instance, matricide. He mentions that one explicitly later in the book. Not where we are now. But later in the book, he says, you know, it's never, never, ever going to be right to kill your mother. You know, there are no circumstances that will justify that. And he has some other examples, too. It's just that's the one that sticks out to me. I think that ultimately it has to do with not that there's a hard and fast distinction between the idea of a theoretical science and a practical science, that any science will have practical elements and theoretical elements, but that ultimately they tilt in one direction or another.
So there's
fair to say, or is that too?
Yeah, that seems fair. And this idea of it being in the realm of becoming, I could also, the way I've sort of pictured it is that it's in this realm of complexity. There are just so many, like even if we wanted to have a science of ethics in the Aristotelian, like strong sense, and even if it was sort of theoretically possible, it seems like he would still admit that there are so many different little twists and situations that in each case we need to sort of deliberate about and you know, don't just neatly fall under a single principle. Yeah, so I at least see that there's a complexity issue here.
Yeah, which I think is probably important, right? Because mm-hmm. we think of the realm, we philosophers tend to think of the realm of being as relatively simple. And I don't mean simple to understand. It's very hard to understand. That's why metaphysics is one of the... It borders on theology. Some people would even say it is theology. Or it borders on, you know, mysticism for some people, right? Because it's not simple in the sense of easy to understand necessarily. But the idea is that the underlying principle of being for most thinkers seems to be one of a kind of unity, of a kind of fullness of, you know, I mean, think of Plotinus and the One, right? The whole mm-hmm. Neoplatonic enterprise is that being as such is one unified field, and then the complexity sort of comes out of the distance from that primary being, at least for Plotinus, right? That matter is as far from that sense of unified being as possible, and so the complexity is within matter, and of course matter is in the realm of becoming, not being, because matter falls apart. It forms and decays and falls apart.
Yes, absolutely. And that kind of is, there's this kind of geometrical background to that idea that we can, if we can just get these basic principles figured out, then everything else will kind of flow out of that.
Yeah. So, okay, so we've just dealt with the first sentence, right? So then he moves on and he says, and this is one of those funny moments. He says, "Hence it is clear that none of the virtues of character comes to us by nature, for nothing that exists by nature is habituated in a different way." And we'll come back to that example in a moment. But you know, it's funny that it starts with hence. Like, I don't see anything... in the, I mean, I guess he's trying to say that it develops through teaching or from habit. So it develops through some kind of intervention of someone else, right? Either someone is habituating you or not, I suppose. You can say it's just, you know, you're left to your own devices, but then you're habituated by circumstance, right? If you imagine a kind of Tarzan figure who's abandoned in the jungle, right, and sort of left to their own devices, they're still going to be habituated. They're just going to be habituated by necessity of circumstance rather than the actions of their parents.
Yeah, actually, that's an important distinction right there when he's basically saying that there's nature on the one hand, and then there's something that we habituate or that we learn on the other, right? So right. Nature is apparently there from the beginning. That's what for him is the sort of like baseline.
Right. Yeah. And so now he's going to work out the relationship of all this to nature, which is a little befuddling. His arguments aren't super strong here, and we'll talk about why in just a second. But you've actually got me thinking about something I find more interesting that Aristotle doesn't really discuss at all, which is the nature of these others in our lives, right? That if we have two basic cycles of developing, one is through habituation, one is through teaching, right? Mm-hmm. Well, some of us, most of us, I would imagine, eventually, once we get to higher education, we pick our teachers to some extent. I mean, not always. Sometimes it's just we just pick whoever has seats available for whatever class. But especially as we move up, you know, and we go to grad school, most of us, when we decided to go to grad school, we probably checked out the various schools and said, oh, I'd like to study with that person. When I went to Columbia, my ideal was to study with Elaine Sisman. It didn't work out that way, but she's the reason I really wanted to be there. She's a famous Mozart scholar. I love Mozart and wanted to work more on Mozart, and she was one of the main reasons I went there. So I picked my teacher. I didn't pick my parents. I got fortunate, you know, with my parents. I'm not complaining, but I didn't pick them. So that's kind of interesting, right? Is that we have these various levels of our own kind of volition in relationship to the people that develop us. In a way, we're back to Heidegger, enthronedness and projection, right? Mm. When I was born, I was thrown into a certain situation. I was thrown into my the state in which I was born, the year. None of that was of my choosing. My parents, I didn't choose them. I didn't choose my class assignment, you know, that I was in the lower middle class or however you want to think of it. And all that is thrownness, right? And so, to a certain extent, habituation participates in this notion of thrownness. Because in my example of Tarzan, right, he's habituated by necessity, by the necessity of circumstance, whatever's happening to him. I'm leaving out the idea that he's adopted by the apes. Let's just have him be sort of scrounging around.
Yeah, figuring it out one thing at a time. Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Whereas with the and in our early teachers, of course, we don't pick either. I mean, maybe our parents pick a school system, but they don't usually pick our exact elementary school teachers. Those are assigned to us just by our last name or however they do it. But as we get older, we start to be more selective in our choice of the people that we pick to teach us and maybe even to habituate us, right? I mean, to a certain extent, even though it's probably less effective, you and I are habituating each other. We're friends and we talk and we sort of learn to think through things in tandem, you know? And so there's still habituation going on. It's probably not as effective. I doubt that you're making me more or less courageous in any super noticeable way. I mean, you might be, I don't know. But whereas, you know, my parents certainly had a huge impact on that, I would imagine.
And you might be getting a little bit of that from when you're playing music with people, right? And then other people in the band maybe kind of are habituating you in that sense and making you more courageous. Yeah.
Or less so. Yeah. I think you're right. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if you think about the physics of playing, the kinesthetics of playing, right? I mean, I notice when I'm playing with certain people for extended periods of time that my feeling of the beat changes because, you know, like our friend Matt, you know, sometimes a long time ago, I used to play jazz with him, and I would find that my approach to swing was different when I was playing with him habitually than it is when I was playing with the drummer I used to work with before playing with Matt, you know.
And is it the kind of thing that you kind of stuck with, or do you only return to that with Matt?
That's a great question. I'm not sure how to answer it, but it relates back to the thing that you said earlier, which you know, about math, where you said that you learn it and then there's that you know, you've learned it and it's
sort of set for all time or kind of
right,
hovering over everything. Yeah,
you don't have any kids yet, so you don't know this, but you'll know from experience that that's not entirely true. As soon as you start trying to teach algebra, which I was great at algebra, and now I'm trying to help my kid with algebra, that stuff didn't stick. You know, I have to reacquaint myself with it.
Well, I don't need to have kids to remember being a kid, and I don't even need, right. It doesn't even to be algebra. I remember long division. The cruelest I've ever been to a teacher is I think it was third grade, she gave us this great lesson on how long division works. There was an example on the board, and for whatever reason, something just didn't work for me, and I raised my hand, she called on me, and I just said, "I don't get it." And that was it. It was one of those moments where you could sort of see her dejection. And then within a few minutes late, I eventually did get it and it clicked. Right. And then the next year in fourth grade, when they're checking to make sure we had learned whatever we had learned, I totally forgot on that very first day what I had learned.
There you go.
And it was only after I thought about it, after a couple days, when it suddenly came back to me. And it's like these things, it's definitely not a clean, easy, you know, but the theory is anyway that there's this sort of knowledge that we can have, and then once acquired, we can kind of hang on to. And maybe it's easier to imagine that with computers or whatever, where you can sort of enter stuff into, you know, onto your smartphone or something, and then just always have it there for you.
Right. Yeah. But the point I'm trying to make is that the distinction's not as clean cut as Aristotle might want us to.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
That our theoretical knowledge, we have to reinforce that too. If I'm not talking about Aristotle or Bergson or Heidegger on a fairly regular basis, I'm going to lose that. And it's not. I invested a lot of hours. I don't want to lose it, but you know, Bergson's the great example for me right now because I'm working on a project that involves Bergson, and you know, it's interesting how many things I retained in my previous readings of Bergson, but it's also amazing how many things that I thought I understood that now are showing up to me as question marks, you know, like his theory of intuition. We don't have to go into that right now, but I thought I had a real handle on it, and it turns out it's much more interesting than I had previously understood, you know, but it's also much more of a question mark. I don't feel like I can, I think I would have had a pretty glib way of explaining it prior to, say, a month ago, and I would have been satisfied with it, hence the glibness. But the Chad that I am now a month later would not be and should not be, and realizes that I don't have a equally secure way of explaining it, and yet I think I have a better grasp of it now.
Yeah,
because it's necessarily fuzzy in a sense.
That's fascinating. So there's this sort of I think I basically just agree with you. There's a kind of messiness with this distinction between theoretical learning and character development, even though he presents it as a relatively clean-cut distinction. And in fact, that messiness sort of goes in the other direction as well, where you made this analogy between thrownness, that kind of Heideggerian concept of the world that we're thrown into, and something that's in us by nature for Aristotle, like from the beginning. And we could probably say that a lot of what makes us who we are is kind of genetic, right? There's something that we can't really, that thrownness is kind of part of our character to begin with. So it's not just something that we learn from a clean slate, the way that sometimes seems like Aristotle suggests we do.
Right, right. Yeah, no, you're right. He doesn't spend a whole lot of time thinking in those sort of ideological terms as far as like physical genetic causation. Granted, he didn't have a theory of genes, but still, like, he must have had some notion. I mean, certainly Plato had a notion of a preformed character before you were even born.
And
for the most part, Aristotle doesn't seem to dwell on that. He never, of course, uses the Lockean phrase clean slate, but I think you're right that he comes kind of close in some ways in his ethical thinking, that, you know, while he doesn't see it as totally under our control because we are at the behest, so to speak, of our habituators, whether they be circumstances or people, he does seem to think that there's not necessarily something that's just in us that makes us the way that we are. But again, you know, having a kid, I feel like there are certain things that I see my boy do, and I'm like, where did that come from? Like, I know he didn't learn that from me or his mother, and he doesn't. It's not like he's got a whole wide social network. Like, where did that come from, this little personality trait of his? Mm-hmm. And it's just inherent somehow, or it seems to be. I mean, I could be wrong. My impression of it is that it's inherent. And Aristotle doesn't spend a lot of time in that. In fact, that's a nice segue into this idea of nature, because he says that as I just read a bit ago, probably seems like a while ago now, but hence it is clear that none of the virtues of character, and it follows that none of the virtues of thought either come from nature, but now he's looking at the virtues of character, because ultimately he's saying what we just said is probably not right. That none of the virtues of character come from nature. And I am kind of suggesting that certain aspects of my son's personality seem to just be inherent, which would mean that they come from nature in some fashion, genes or whatever. But he says none of them do. Now, the way that he backs this up is, I think, flawed. And see if you agree, right? Here's his example. He says, nothing that exists by nature is habituated in a different way. For instance, a stone, which naturally falls downward, can't be habituated to travel upwards, even if you throw it up in the air 10,000 times, right? And you can't force fire to go down, right? So they do these things by their nature. So the only thing that he's shown, though, if the idea is that he's trying to show that... he's trying to show two things, right? That What we do with virtue doesn't come directly from nature, but at the same time, it's not contrary to nature. And the only thing that he's done so far is to show that the only thing that he's actually done so far is he's shown that it's not contrary to nature. That's right, because he said. Because that's what the stone example is. I throw the stone up a bunch of times, it never flies up in the air because that's contrary to its nature. So we have virtues, so therefore it's clear that having virtues is not contrary to our nature. Mm-hmm. But he hasn't yet demonstrated that virtues aren't simply natural. He's just said that they aren't because we are habituated or we've learned.
Yeah, but so he's not making a strong argument. There's not like a strong case against us being born a certain way, basically.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. All he says is that we're born with capacities, which seems to, in a way, further muddy the waters, as we'll see. Right. He says the virtues don't come to us by nature, neither are they contrary to nature, but it is natural to us to be receptive of them, and we are perfected in them through habit. That, you know, this idea of of perfection through our own efforts is interesting, mm-hmm. right? This sort of, there's an almost existentialist preview here. It's not full on Sartre, of course, but there's a, right? Like he's saying that we have certain natural capacities, but those capacities kind of go in both directions. Like the same capacity that would make us courageous can also make us cowardly. It depends on how we relate to that capacity. Hmm. And that makes it different from sight and other things that he's about to mention as being capacities. Because with sight, as long as we are not somehow, deficient, like naturally deficient, if we're blind, born blind, for example, or born with some kind of sight issue, then that would be a natural deficiency. But as long as we're born with the apparatus that is normative, mm-hmm. then it's not a, we can't be good or bad seers based on that, right? That we have the capacity and we do the thing. Yeah. We can be more or less percipient or perspicuous, right? We can be more or less observant, but our actual capacity to see in the literal sense of I'm holding up two objects and I see two objects, that can't be a deficiency. But with virtues, it seems like he does think that capacity can go in either direction.
Yeah, so the ability to see is already there or not by nature,
right.
Whereas right. the ability maybe to recognize something by sight, that's more like what he's getting at with character. Would you agree with that analogy?
To some extent, except yeah. I think I'm trying to radicalize it more than you just did.
Oh, okay.
Because what I'm interested in, I do agree with what you just said, but I'm trying to go just a tiny bit farther, which is maybe a lot farther, depending on how you understand it, which is that I'm trying to set up a way in which he's getting to the doctrine of the mean, mm. right? Because there's no doctrine of the mean really for sight. You either can see or you can't see. Like I said, you could be more or less perspicuous. You could be more or less discerning in what you see and in characterizing it, but that's different. With the virtues, what I'm suggesting is that we have this capacity for let's not call it courage or cowardliness yet. Let's just say we have a capacity for reacting to adversity, and that can go in either direction, right? Whereas sight really can't. And so this is one of those distinctions here that, because, and he doesn't do what I just did with it, but he says, look, in the case of things that do come to us by nature, we get the capacities for them first, and later we manifest or exercise, like the senses, right? So I have the capacity to see, and then I see. I don't have to practice it. Once the capacity is in place, right, which for human beings is pretty much from birth, I think they see fuzzy when they first come out of the womb, but almost from birth. Whereas kittens, of course, are blind for however many, what is it, a week? However long it is, they're blind when they're first born, right? But whenever that stops, it's not like they have to practice seeing, at least in Aristotle's view, right? They just see. Now, I don't know that this is true because I don't have any memory of when I was starting out and seeing, you know? I mean, I don't think too many of us do. Right, but his argument is that seeing is a capacity that's there, and then you don't have to do anything to activate it. It's simply there.
Yeah.
Whereas we have a capacity for virtues, and but we have to do something about it. We have to basically practice that.
Yeah,
we learned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I still think my analogy, since we're talking about sight, still kind of works. It's really it's kind of dumb because it's hard to imagine the extremes, but I could imagine someone looking at something and thinking, that's not a building, that's not a building, that's not a building, even if they're looking at buildings. So they think basically nothing they see is a building except for this one house that they grew up in or something, right? And then someone else thinks everything's a building. They see a mountain and they think that's a pretty big building over there.
Okay.
Whereas recognizing the skill of actually recognizing a building, that's one that you eventually, you have to kind of learn over time. Even if it's
but don't you think there's a distinction between that and, like, in all of the examples, even though they mislabeled what they were seeing, they were all seeing the thing that they were seeing.
Hmm.
Or, unless you think that you're not really seeing it unless the sort of circuit is completed and you see it and you correctly identify it. But I guess it seems to me that Aristotle's making a distinction here.
Yeah.
That in your example, all three of those people saw the thing that they were seeing. It's just two of them misidentified it.
Yes, but identifying something correctly or recognizing it, that's the thing that I think is the part that's sort of analogous, at least in the way it works, to what he's getting at with character virtues, where there are these sort of dispositions to basically like a capacity to gain a capacity, I guess.
I see.
So, yeah.
Huh.
But yeah, I mean, I'll think more about it. Maybe it's too general, or maybe it's too unrelated to actual virtues, and we'll have to sort of figure out where those distinctions are.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think Aristotle yet is talking about perception in the full sense of I see this thing and I get a sense of what it means and how it relates to everything else, which would be a fuller notion of perception. Mm-hmm. I think he just means something was seen, something was registered.
Yes,
through the eyes.
Absolutely,
the
yeah. That's yeah. the part that's in us by nature, is just
right.
being sensitive to the world in certain ways.
Right. Yeah. And mm-hmm. and so you feel like he's making, am I following this correctly? Do you feel like he's making too sharp of a distinction then between what goes on with the senses and what goes on with the virtues? That in a way, if we extend the senses to include actual perception, then there's more of an analogy here, that we're born with a disposition to see, and we learn through habit and maybe even through some theoretical teaching to be percipient, to perceive things well. So the apparatus is the same in everyone as long as it's fully functioning, mm-hmm. but the person who's able to see the distinct, like let's use a more mundane example, the person who looks up in the sky and says, that's a cumulus cloud and that's a cirrus cloud or whatever, mm-hmm. That they're more perceptive because they see distinctions where the other person just sees clouds.
Yes, exactly, where you kind of you can learn to recognize things, and sometimes you can sort of go overboard and make sort of needless distinctions or overly detailed distinctions, like, or things that don't seem to matter, you know, and so there's an element there of sort of doing it wrong.
Right.
But like it could also be done in a relatively appropriate way to your situation. Yeah, so basically I'm sort of sticking with the analogy for now, but I'm willing to give up the analogy if it...
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then he goes on. So he says that, you know, you don't acquire the senses through frequent acts of seeing. You just have the senses and then you use them. But that's not the case with the virtues. And he says that he makes his own analogy to skills. He says it's similar to skills. Now, he's not clear at this stage, at least, where he's drawing the line between skills and virtues. He's just sort of making this one analogy, and later in a later chapter he'll make more distinctions, but at this point it's pretty much all analogy and all comparison, mm-hmm. No contrast. And he says that for what one has to learn to do, we learn by doing. Now notice he says learn, or at least this translation says learn, which might sound like it's coming from teaching, but he's talking about habituation here, right? Mm-hmm. Now this is important. It's more important than it seems, because later in book 5, but it might be book 6, he's going to return to the issue of skills, and he's going to align skills, at least certain productive skills in particular, he's going to align them more closely with thought than with habit and character. But that's not clear in this stage, and when we get to that, we're going to have to ask ourselves whether or not he's being consistent or not. But here, because he's talking about the virtues of character, so he's talking about habit, not theoretical teaching, right? And you can see that in the way that he uses the example. He says that we learn by doing. So people become builders by building, and lyre players by playing the lyre. And so too, we become just by performing just acts, and temperate by temperate acts, and we become courageous by performing courageous acts, right? Okay, so there are a couple of things that are interesting about that. One is, when we're building, I think that's pretty unproblematically a product, a productive art, right? The idea of building, you can call your build, you know, I've even known people who call themselves architects, but they've never designed a building. And I don't mean they've never had one built. I mean, they've never designed a building. Mm-hmm. It's even more common to see people that call themselves poets and playwrights who've never completed a poem or a play, right? Like, especially young people, but I know people my own age who still claim that they are things that they've not actually done. And so you can say, well, you clearly are, you have the capacity for it. Pretty much anyone does, but you haven't actually done it. Can you really call yourself a builder, right? So the builder properly is someone who's built something, who's left behind a product. Mm-hmm. But ethics doesn't leave behind a product, right? Or does it? I mean, it has certain outcomes, obviously. If we're courageous, we might help somebody in a time of need. Or if we're generous, we might help somebody in a time of need. They wound up having the same product. But so there is an output of some sort. But at least for Aristotle, that's not why we do it, right? We deal with virtues because they are excellences. They are a way of living our best life. Those other things are to the side of it. Whereas the house, being a builder, I mean, I'm sure there are people that would argue that this isn't true, but if, at least for Aristotle, it doesn't seem to me that he's saying that being a builder, we do it just to live our best life. We do it to leave behind buildings. Mm-hmm. Right? So this is one of the ways in which the analogy breaks down. But then the reason I'm belaboring the point is because you and I are both musicians, and the other example is lyre playing. Is playing music, but does playing music leave behind a product? So is it closer to the building example because it's a skill, so it's clearly meant to be grouped with the mm-hmm. building in that sense, or is it in some ways a bridge? Is he being really sneaky here, and he's given us one example, building, which is fairly easy to understand because building leaves behind a product, and virtue leaves behind products in some ways, but not really. That's not really the emphasis. And music is kind of like that, because music, there is a kind of, we produce sound, we produce an experience, whatever, but it's not something you can take home with you, you know, unless you recorded it. But even then, you're not really taking home the experience. You're taking home a new experience, or at least a new potential experience that's captured on the tape or on your phone or whatever. Yeah, I don't know. What do you? Am I tilting at nonsense here? What do you make of?
I kind of agree that there's something easier, at least if we're looking for a closer analogy to what he's after with virtue. There is something that works a little more smoothly, I guess, with the musical example, where you're just sort of you. Although we can say you create music, you're making the music as a kind of activity. And then once you're done with that activity, then the music is done as well. You don't leave it behind in the same way that a virtuous action you don't leave behind. But on the other hand, there is something kind of thing-like about an action that has an ethical import to it. Like there's a reason why we can imagine a painting of a hero doing a heroic thing, right? It kind of, there's something about it that kind of holds still, that can get left behind. I don't know. That's my sort of intuitive thought about how the analogy does work for the builder.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting way of putting it. So you think that the painting of the heroic action is not an attempt to make sure I'm following you correctly. There's something really cool here. It's just not easy to put in the words, right? Which might mean that it's really cool. So the painting of the heroic action for you, if I'm understanding you correctly, is a demonstration that something gets left behind. So first of all, what does this painting look like? Like let's say, like Andromeda, like saving her from the dragon or whatever. Like that would be an example, right?
Okay.
Now, so Perseus, if I'm even remembering the legend correctly, I think it's Perseus saves Andromeda from a dragon, right? She's chained to a rock to be sacrificed to a dragon. I might be mixing up myths. If I am, let's just stick with what I have and not worry about it. And there are plenty of paintings of that event, mm-hmm. or that mythical moment. But when I'm looking at that painting, you're suggesting that something is left behind, like there's a product of the virtuous behavior. Well, there's an outcome of it. She's freed from the dragon. But is that something that stays behind, or is that just continuing the sort of process of becoming and the unfolding of time that we're all enveloped in anyway? Like when I think of something being left behind as a product, I think of something object-like, and there's nothing object-like.
Yes, well, maybe that's what that is what I'm sort of suggesting. Like in our sort of normal, if you think of your everyday life, how often you're doing something that is truly sort of on the level of what you might think of as an ethical act, whether it's an actually like positive ethical act or negative ethical act, but something that has some kind of ethical import to it. Most of the time, if I'm just sort of moving from one room to another, that's just time kind of passing as I'm going from one room to the other. And I suppose I could screw that up. I could like stub my toe or something. But even then, that becomes that takes on a kind of import, right? Where it's like, oh, that's the moment where, right? And it kind of holds together as a kind of a single noun-like moment, right? When things become moments, I feel like that is a way in which they're left behind, and often
You're talking about events.
Yes, events.
Like the Heideggerian sense, right?
Yeah, sure.
That an event is a kind of opening up of a new clearing, a new set of possibilities.
Yeah.
And so therefore, it's not just an object; it's a shifting of a world. That's really interesting. Is that what you're sort of?
Well, there's a potential for something to change. But also there's something kind of object-like about it too, that kind of time itself sort of stops in a way when that happens. And when a musician, when the lyre player plays well, for the listeners, they're enraptured. Time kind of stops for them. And then of course if the builder does a good job, then the thing he gets left behind is something he can be proud of. And it's not even so much the building that matters as the good job on the building. You know what I mean? Like the sort of the act of creating it well is what is truly left behind.
Okay. So then that leads us to the next bit, because I'm curious now what you're going to say about this next bit. And let's see if I can make the connection that I'm seeing clear. So the next, he talks about politics for a bit, and we'll skip that because it doesn't necessarily, he just says that, you know, that's what politicians do, right? Is they try to make citizens good by habituating them and so on. Mm-hmm. But then he says, every excellence is created and destroyed by the same source and the same means. And similarly, every skill, so this is another analogy between virtue and skill, for it is from playing the lyre that people become good and bad lyre players, similarly with builders and all the rest. For people will be good builders from building well and bad from building badly. If this were not so, there'd be no need of a teacher, which is because everyone would just be born good or bad, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you can get from the teacher bit a bit of what he's thinking, right? That if we're given the wrong way of approaching, like if we're inculcated with bad habits. Musicians are a good example for this, right? I mean, as a teacher, I've told all my students to play with metronomes, and none of them do, and I rarely do. I'm trying to be better about it now, but for most of my life, I've been pretty bad about it, right? So there's a good example of me not inculcating a habit that would have been good for me, that would have made me a better musician. And so you're practicing your bad habits, in a sense. So you can see how one could become a bad musician by continuing to perform badly, but there is something almost paradoxical about it, right? Like you're a musician, you continue to perform, and that will either lead you to being good or bad. So other than finding the right teacher, I suppose, and making sure that you're inculcating the right habits, it's a little bit paradoxical.
I agree. Right. It's the learn by doing paradox, where it feels right when to hear that idea that you can, the best way to learn anything is to go out and do it. And like, yes, actually, that does seem true in a certain way, but I agree. It's something that's absurd in other ways, especially when you're just getting started, because you need, that's when you need the most help to I know I'm supposed to learn it by doing, but how do I even make a sound out of this thing?
Right. And are you really doing, in a sense, like are you really, when I'm first teaching them to play guitar, am I really teaching them to play guitar, or am I teaching them to pluck a string? Mm-hmm. And then they build on the plucking a string, and then holding the finger in the right spot on the fret. And so, and you know, even when I teach them, let's say I teach them Smells Like Teen Spirit. That's one I do a lot with my beginner students, because you move from, if you just do it as a one note thing, you move from the first fret on the lowest string to the first fret on the next string up, then the fourth fret of the lowest string to the fourth fret of the next string up. So it's really easy. It's an easy pattern for them to remember. Mm-hmm. And it's a familiar tune for many people and so on. But even if I've taught them to play that song, have I really taught them to play guitar yet? Or is there a kind of slow accretion that happens, and then it's almost like a Sorites argument. Like, you don't know when it goes from I'm just learning the skills that will eventually go to playing music to actually playing music. There's almost a, mm-hmm. right, a subtle trajectory there.
Yeah, there's like a feedback loop that has to happen.
Right. And, which he's going to talk about in the next chapter, so we'll mm-hmm. save the feedback loop bit. But, I mean, this paradox, if we want to call it that, is one that always reminds me of Hegel, because Hegel talks about this with his example, swimming, right? You don't learn swimming from reading a book. You learn swimming by being tossed in the deep end and trying to work your way through it. So you can only learn swimming by swimming. And mm-hmm. and he says that something's very similar with philosophy and so on, that you don't learn it and then do it. You learn it by doing it. But there's a little bit of a paradox there, yeah. right? Because if you sort of think of it like almost like a life meter in a video game, right? And when you're first, when you really know the skill, then your life meter is all filled up. You know everything about it. You can do it super well. When you're pretty good at it, but you still got a lot to learn. Let's say you're halfway there. But what about when you're first starting?
And that thing you just die over and over and over again, right?
Right. It should be empty. So then, how do you get, I can understand once you have the first notch, how you build from there, but like, how is it that we go about doing these things from nothing, except what I just said, where what I'm teaching someone when I'm first teaching them to pluck a string is not really playing guitar yet at all. I'm just applying something that they already know from hitting their own toys or whatever, right? From moving their hands in certain ways. And I'm having them apply it to this thing. And at that stage, it's just another form of hitting, ultimately, mm-hmm. and not really playing music yet.
So are you suggesting that maybe there's an element of theory that has to be there? It's not just a matter of habituation? Like that there's
actually, I wasn't suggesting that, although I think that's probably true. But that's not what I was suggesting. What I was suggesting is that we have to start in a sort of cross domain situation, that we're applying skills from one domain to another.
Gotcha.
That it's once we've established a certain amount of crossover from one domain to several other domains, perhaps, to this new domain, mm-hmm. that once you've accreted a certain amount of that then there's a kind of almost avalanche effect where it goes from I've applied all these skills to this new domain, now I'm in the new domain. I'm properly
in the new
domain.
Yeah, so kind of almost like mapping things from one area to another, but it's never a perfect mapping, so we have to work by analogy and by similarity rather than the sort of precise exact one-to-one kind of things.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking about it, right? You can almost think of it like living in New York could be propedeutic, could be something that prepares you for living in, say, Chicago, right? And if you're just thinking about following numbered streets and then named streets and them getting mixed up and so on, the general way of navigating, and there's obviously public transportation in both, bus system connected to a rail system, so there are all sorts of analogies. But if I lived in New York, as I did for 20 some years, and then I just moved to Chicago, it's not like I know Chicago just from knowing New York. There are certain things that apply, mm-hmm. and so I can, as a city dweller in a different city, there are certain skills that I'm bringing to bear here in this new domain, but I don't know what it is to live in Chicago until I've applied enough of those skills to then being enveloped in Chicago-ness.
So there are sort of broad things that you can expect from Chicago, even if you don't know exactly where anything is. You can sort of think, well, there's probably a public transportation system. You know, it's either going to be buses or trains or something right. between the two.
And it's not going to work so radically different. I mean,
exactly,
it is different,
yeah.
of course.
Yeah.
I'm more familiar with D.C., let's say, than Chicago. And the D.C. subway system works very differently from the New York subway. But basically, it's mm-hmm. the same. I mean, you might scratch your head at first, like, wait, I got to get a ticket. I don't just have a card. And I got to figure out the exact change or else it gets mad. But and so some of those things don't
Yeah, it would be a lot more absurd if you went to like a JFK airport and then they called it the subway or something, right? And Delta subway, and you're like, wait, but I thought the subway worked this way. Whereas it totally makes sense when you go to to DC and you take their subway, and even though it looks different, and there's a different payment system and all that stuff. There's this basic functionality that's the same ballpark.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So we get good at we develop the virtues by acting virtuously, and maybe part of the mechanism for that is what we were just saying, that it's not like you have to somehow be already somewhat courageous in order to be courageous. You have to have certain skills that may not be determinant of courage versus cowardliness, but that when you apply them the right way, they develop into either courage or cowardliness.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, you can be sort of courageous as a kid in a very basic, like in a game setting, right? And then you start to apply that to different other fields of your life. And,
right.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on to book two, or chapter two, rather, of book two, unless there's anything else that you wanted to say.
Yeah, I don't know if any listeners are obsessed with the stuff about the leaders sort of being like... That's the part we skipped over just now about the leaders being basically making good citizens by habituating them. But yeah, that's.
Oh, you think I skipped the tricky passage there?
I don't know how tricky it is, but there's stuff that we I'm sort of like, I'm not sure how should we conclude basically that Aristotle is just being straightforwardly paternalistic here with the idea that leaders are kind of like. Parents, basically, or like teachers, and
yeah. I mean, he lived in a democracy, but he didn't think that highly of democracy. Mm-hmm. He was like Plato in that way. Aristotle makes it very clear that what he thinks is the best system is an aristocracy. That these would be people who are themselves virtuous and therefore can guide other people toward virtue.
Yeah, I guess that there's
good.
Oh, just my sort of question about this is more. It's almost more not so much is he being paternalistic or how is he handling authority, but how sort of limited or broad in scope is he imagining this habituation is supposed to be? Maybe that's my sort of the one that kind of sticks with me. The question about that passage that sticks with me, like I'm not sure if. How much basically the fingers of the legislators are supposed to be in the everyday lives of the citizens.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're really getting into something else now.
Yeah,
but
it's
worth thinking about a bit. Like, I think we tend to, and you tell me if you think otherwise, but I think we tend to do a kind of weird double consciousness with our view of politics these days. On the one hand, we want them to simply be administrators. You do the things that we need done, make sure that we have roads that we can drive on, depending mm-hmm. on who you are, you either want public education funded or you don't, right? We don't have to have the same goals, but we often treat politicians as though ideally they're just good administrators that get done the things that we want to get done. And yet we can't seem to help. Maybe because it's impossible not to, or at least in current situations, of seeing these politicians as somehow emblematic of the mores and the attitudes of us. After all, we call them representatives, right? They're supposed to in some way represent us. And when I think of someone like let's not, I'm going to try not to even be judgmental. I'm sure anyone listening will know exactly how I feel about the person I'm about to bring up, but let's think about this for a moment. Marjorie Taylor Greene, right? Mm-hmm. She's a very interesting person in certain ways, because there's no mistaking that she's always playing a role, right? And I'm not saying that that's not genuinely who she is. It might be, but she's very clear that she's performative.
Yeah, she has a little smirk that lets you know she's not totally being serious. Yeah.
Yeah, which what is the nature of that exactly? Like, what is it? So if obviously the people that vote for her must feel that she aligns with their values in some way. I mean, the reason I picked her is because she's a defender of the January 6th, what she would call patriots, right? Mm-hmm. The January 6th insurrectionists, but she would call them patriots. She's clearly, anti-abortion and all the rest. Those are all things that have to do with values. in moral judgments. And she comports herself in this very bellicose manner. She's willing to be quite rude and disrespectful and you know, what we would normally think of as not necessarily comporting herself in a responsible manner, you know, like she's had to be asked to leave places and so on because she's behaving in a not entirely polite manner. I'm trying to pick my words carefully because I'm not trying to stack deck here, you know. So what do we make of, like, what do you make of a of her role there? Like she's clearly not just an administrator. The fact that I know who she is and she's not in my state, or you know, she's not someone that I would ever be in a position to elect or not elect. I know who she is because of the kind of moral character that she represents.
Well, that's actually a really interesting example, partly because this dichotomy that you set up, she doesn't really fit in either side of it, the dichotomy being politician as administrator kind of background. I often think of local politics as sort of focused on administration, versus the politician as a kind of carrier of the ethos of their people, right? The representative in that sense. Whereas the example you gave, Marjorie Taylor Greene, there's this feeling of almost like a game being played, an us versus them game being played, right, that has an in order to aspect to it, like in order to sort of arrive at a certain outcome that, you know, that, so it's like it's a way of sort of shaping discourse in order to get to a certain point without actually literally falling on the side of a certain sort of ethos or disappearing into administration. Yeah, no, I think that's kind of a fascinating example. I'm also not sure what to make of it. That's just my first sort of response.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the part of the reason it occurs to me, and I don't want to make this a political broadcast podcast, obviously, but when you think about the border bill, for example, right, and the way that it gets squashed, even though many experts say on both sides of the so-called aisle say that, you know, this is one of the bills that really should have appealed to the Republicans, is probably the best deal that they're going to get on the border and so on. It really did. And that they really defeated it simply so Biden wouldn't get credit for it, wouldn't get a win or whatever. And I'm not saying this is fact. This is how people have represented this moment. I don't know. Who knows? But that to me seems to be a sort of interesting move that's not administrative so much as it is. I don't know. Is it ethical? It has to do with, I don't know, in a way, kind of diminishing the accomplishments of your declared enemy, only to hurt yourself in a way. But you know, like,
it's sort of a rhetorical tool that is useful, I think, by any good politician. And we can pick politicians on either side of the aisle who sort of do it on occasion and sometimes do it well and sometimes go too far. But it seems like there's that kind of, we'll just say, we often use the term politicization in American politics. Right. So we can just use that, right? When you want to politicize something, you're sort of creating an us against them kind of mentality, or we are standing together in order to blah, 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 blah. And that's an important rhetorical tool, sort of shaping your people. But sometimes it gets, I don't know, turned into a kind of affectation that you just want to do all the time because it helped you at some point, right? And
I think what you're doing, actually, for me at least, for this listener, is you're convincing me that she is sort of taking an ethical stance, right? A very basic ethical stance, which is what you just said, the us versus them. I mean, think about it this way. I don't know how many people are in this country. Billions, right? I don't know. Millions or billions? Doesn't matter. Some big number. I don't know how many there are. Because I know people, I know that probably no two of them, of all those millions or billions, whatever it is, no two of them are alike, right? And yet we've divided up our political spectrum to be basically one of three things. You're right, you're left, or you're undecided in the middle, right? You're independent or whatever. And and the undecided thing is getting more and more of a precarious position to be in, it seems, right? Because so much of American politics is really about an us versus them, which is a gross oversimplification, obviously. And yet it's very effective, because if I could say everything they do is wrong, I don't have to tell you what's right. It's just whatever they're doing is wrong, and so therefore we can stop that and we do the opposite. I don't have to make a convincing argument for anything then. It's all a binary. It all becomes a zero or a one.
Yeah. Yeah, you've already decided what the truth is, and at this point it's just about acting on it.
Right.
Yeah.
And without even worrying about consistency or anything else. No. That's why I use the border bill as the example. That seems to me, as someone who's not deeply political, when that first happened, I thought, well, that's grossly contradictory. Like, what they clearly want is basically in that bill, at least as much of it as they're going to get. And so why? It's like you're cutting off your nose to spite your face. But it's not, right? Because what's important is the maintenance of the enemy more than the actual policy.
Yeah. So I guess we could say that the thing that certain politicians, at least in America, are doing is they're habituating, if we're going in the Aristotelian direction, they're habituating us to what they're up to as building a constituency of some kind, where they're forming a coalition, right? Coalition forming is part of politics, but for they're habituating us to this idea that that's what all of politics is just right. Coalition building.
Right.
Yeah.
No, and because you're right. I think that's the key here, that they're taking what was a tool that you build a coalition so that you get things done because power is in the masses and so on, right? The power in the people. Mm. And what you've done is you've said that this thing that was a tool, a means to an end, is now the end. That the end is simply that we divide up according to... it's not even clear what it's according to. I guess it's some kind of underlying belief system, but it seems pretty muddy in a lot of ways because, like I said... there are plenty of people that are on the left that don't agree with each other, plenty of people that are on the right that don't agree with each other. But when it comes down to the basic things, it divides in this sort of Manichaean sense of an all or nothing. You're either on that side or you're on this side.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Well, we went a little long here, so let's sort of quickly do chapter two, and then if there are other things that we want to talk more about, we can pick it up in the next sure. episode. But we'll be somewhat schematic here.
Yeah.
Chapter two is the theory of action, it seems to me, right? He says if the idea is that the point of this isn't to just have theoretical knowledge, but to actually become good, then we have to have some sense of what that means. And if the idea is to put our notions of ethics into act, then we have to have a theory of what even constitutes an act. How does act work? And he starts off with some presuppositions. He's not going to prove them yet. He's just stating them as things that are the case, or have to be thought of as the case. He says, it's agreed that we should act in accordance with correct reason, and mm-hmm. let that be our assumption, right? So he's not trying to prove it exactly. He's just saying, well, in a way, he's already proven it with the function argument, I guess, back in chapter 7 of book 1, but he's not gonna go any further. Then he says, also, let's agree in advance that every discussion of practical questions must be expressed in outline and not precisely, which he's already said, right? He says, he backs that one up a little bit more, though. He says, practical matters and questions of what is advantageous contain nothing fixed, just like things to do with health. What the hell is he talking about? Well, let's start with the analogy. What does he mean, nothing is fixed with health? How does that work?
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating, actually, that he even starts with health at the beginning instead of using one of his other examples. But I have to admit, I'm not really particularly... I guess it seems like he's just sort of... setting up that if we are living our lives in a healthy way, then basically we're not aiming at excess or deficiency, right? And in fact, that's his connection with character, that these things tend to be ruined if we go too far in one way or the right. other.
So that's definitely true.
And yeah. he's kind of setting up, like we said at the very, very beginning of the podcast, that he's sort of setting up this argument that's leading toward the doctrine of the mean and kind of getting us used right. to the feeling of the doctrine of the mean,
right.
especially
he's now. Habituating us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
Sorry about my dog, right. by the way. He's also getting used to all of this stuff.
Yeah, of course. He's being habituated too. But, But no, I think that's true, that he's sort of bringing in the doctrine of the mean in a very sort of subtle way here, and that's going to be the case all the way through to book six, where he's refining it as he goes along. But what I actually was thinking of is more this nothing fixed thing. And I think what he's after with health, let's start with health with the analogy and then we'll get to the ethics, is you know, there's no, you can't just give people a list to say, these are the things you do to be healthy. I mean, we do it all the time, but it has to be adjusted to the person, right? I'm a relatively fragile, underweight, thin, skinny dude, right? And so my workout regime can't be the same as my brother, who's this stacked, big, muscly guy, right? It doesn't mean that I don't have a health regimen and he has a health regimen. It's that they can't be the same because I can't do the same things that he can do, right?
Oh, I see. I see. Yeah. So there's a situational thing happening here.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I think is being. And when we go to a doctor, we don't expect the doctor to just say, well, a person who's 50 years old, male, with these conditions, this is what you always do. No, he looks at the whole thing, right? The whole set of circumstances. It's that's why they ask about, you know, what allergies do you have? It's because the prescribed medicine for most people might be something that would actually harm you. You have to have the full picture. Right?
Yeah. So there's always some gap basically between the kind of general principle, you know, eat well and exercise, and the specific situation where it's like, well, how much does that mean? What exactly am I supposed to eat when I'm this old versus that old? And exercise, I mean, for me, climbing stairs can feel like really heavy exercise sometimes. So like, what are we talking about? So yeah, there's that gap between the kind of overall principle and then the kind of fine tuning that we have to do with each particular situation.
Right. So then you would think, okay, so what he means is that we can't have precise principles. The principles have to be kind of fuzzy, and then they'll become more precise in application. That's what I would have read that as being what's said, right? What's being said. But then he immediately goes on and he does the exact opposite of what I just assumed, right? Because what I just assumed was that the principles will become more concrete, they'll become more clear once you start applying them to an actual practical situation. Right. So we might have a fuzzy principle of something like don't harm other people. And yet when someone's trying to mug us and the only way to deflect them is to kick them in the gut and run, then, you know, that might be an exception to that. So now it's not as fuzzy. Right. It's being applied in a concrete way. But that's not what he says. He says, and the discussion of general principles being of that kind, it is even more the case. That the discussion of particular cases does not have precision, right?
Yeah.
So even the discussion of particular cases, he says, does not have precision. He writes, for it does not fall under any skill or manual of instruction, but those who act must themselves always have regard to the particular circumstances, as is the case in medicine and steersmanship, right? So it seems to me there are two things that are not teased out very well by Aristotle. And you tell me if I'm making too many distinctions, but it seems to me there's a distinction among two things. On the one hand, there's the principles, the general principles. There are principles. Do not kill, do not harm each other, act courageously. It's just those are fuzzy. What does it mean to act courageously, right? Is running into a burning building where there's no animal or no living thing whatsoever, is that courageous or is that foolhardy, right? Seems to me that's probably foolhardy, but how do you know? That's not clear yet, right?
Okay.
So you have the general principles. But then he says that the other aspect is that even in particular cases, there are no general principles. And so how do we know how to act? Or there are no principles that become more concrete is what I'm trying to say. So how do we know how to act in those cases?
So I'm just to understand what you're sort of focused on. There's the fuzzy principle versus clear principle distinction. And then there's the problem of general versus particular as sort of a separate problem.
Right. Because then you would think, I would assume from the first part, that if in the general sense of things, the overall view, there's only fuzzy principles. There are principles, but mostly fuzzy. There are some exceptions, like we said. There's even an exception to the exception rule, which is stuff like matricide and so on, where there's never a justification for it. And he's going to say that later. I'm not making that up, I promise. So that's kind of nice, right? That there are always exceptions, including to the rule that there are always exceptions. Mm-hmm. But But then when he moves to the particular, what I would assume is that things become more concrete. But he says that it's even more the case that that nothing's fixed when you start looking at particular cases.
Yeah. No, that's basically the way I read him, actually, from the beginning, where there's that gap between the principle and then the specific situation. And the more specific the situation, the less he can basically say about it, or the less he can sort of tell us about it in this inquiry.
Right. So then we have an interesting problem, which is how do we apply these fuzzy principles to a particular case where they don't become sharper in their set of distinctions, but rather they maintain their sort of fuzziness become even more so in a way. That's not the trajectory. Do you see what I'm getting at, or am I being stupid?
I think so.
Here?
Although maybe a picture I have in my head, a sort of illustrative picture of how this might turn out. I'm imagining a kind of graph that tracks the improvement of our character. It can be anything, any aspect of our character you like. Let's just stick with, imagine a graph for any aspect of your character. And at the beginning, it's sort of almost vertical, where there are these big leaps that sort of, where we are learning how to appropriately respond in broadly regular sorts of situations that happen pretty often. And then as we develop our character more and more, the graph starts to level off. It starts to become less vertical and more horizontal, right? Where, you know, even if we're aiming toward hitting 100% or whatever, and we never quite hit it because we keep hitting these increasingly kind of niche adjustments we have to make. And I think maybe what he's getting at is that there's only so much he can give us to make those first leaps, and beyond that, when we get to those really niche situations, then it's going to basically be up to us to make those adjustments.
I agree with that to a large extent, but I think he's after something a little more too. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I might be making too much out of it, but it seems to me what he's saying is, and we can almost use your graph analogy, or at least I'm trying to develop a way to use your graph analogy, that there are certain very general principles that for the most part will hold true. Don't kill people, don't hurt people, don't lie, don't steal, right? But that when we get down to brass tacks, when we get down to specific situations, these things that were fuzzy but seemed generally acceptable get tested in a way that can be kind of surprising and revealing, that those like you know, the example that I used earlier, that it's not right to harm other people, but there are certain cases where it becomes inevitable, or it becomes something that you have to do. Like, for instance, let's say that you broke your leg and it's set in the wrong way. What does the doctor have to do to make it right? They have to re-break it. Mm-hmm. So they have to hurt you in order to help you, right?
Yeah.
Now, the general principle, don't hurt other people, seems like that's a perfectly fine principle. But in this case, he's actually helping you by hurting you.
Sure.
Right?
And in fact, there's even more generally, so something that pretty much everyone has experienced is either a doctor or a nurse about to stab you with something or whatever and saying, you may feel a little prick, or, you know, there's going to be some pressure here, which is just a euphemism for I'm going to put you in pain.
I'm
going to
hurt you. Yeah. I'm going to hurt you now, and it's for your own good. And so once you get down to actual, and that's again the simplicity of being versus the complexity of becoming, right? That when we're thinking in the larger, and the reason it has to be fuzzy even on the larger order is because we're talking about human beings who are, of course, in the realm of becoming. But once we're talking about particular cases, it's like we're going deeper into the general principles are a zoomed out view of the realm of becoming. But as we get deeper into it, into the nuances of it, the grit, the grain of it, that the complexity just keeps accumulating.
Sure, but so does our mastery. I would assume that's his idea, right? With each sort of test of a principle, that we start to understand it in a deeper way.
I would hope so. Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't know that I think that that's built into this particular passage, but I think it's probably part of his overall trajectory. Yeah. Mm. And then the rest of it is, like you said, it's slyly introducing the notion of the mean, right? That we have, he says, we should first consider the things of that kind. So what he means are the skills and the virtues that we're developing are such as to be destroyed by deficiency and excess, right? So he gives the example of strength and health, right? If how do you become strong? He says, well, you eat a lot and you exercise a lot, right? But if you eat too much, you become fat. If you exercise too much, you wear yourself out. Mm-hmm. Like there's a way in which you can go too far. You can, everyone who works out knows this, right? You can hurt yourself and you can do really quite a bit of damage. My brother's a good example. My brother loves to run and it's good for his heart. It's terrible for his legs. And he's chosen his heart over his legs. Mm-hmm. So he has to go in for surgeries and he has to have all sorts of physical therapy because he's more concerned with his heart than his legs, right? So there's a trade-off. Health for one leads to the deleterious effect on the other.
Hmm. Yeah.
And so finding the right mean, and I'm not saying he has or hasn't, but that's what Aristotle's trying to encourage us to do, is find the right balance, like not going too far. And he gives further examples, right? Like the temperate versus the intemperate person. The person who enjoys every pleasure and abstains from none becomes intemperate. But the person who avoids every pleasure, as boars do, becomes a sort of insensible person, right? doesn't have any life to them in a sense. And so both of these extremes are wrong. But of course, the fuzzy nature of the doctrine of the mean is then what's the right formula?
Exactly.
And this is of course something that we're going to talk about a lot in coming sessions.
It's actually kind of helpful just to know his process here too, where he kind of starts off with obvious, observations, things that we all kind of would agree on, sort of initial examples, and then sort of lead to, well, what's the principle underneath all of this stuff?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so the big question will be, how fuzzy exactly is the doctrine of the mean? Are we just saying that we don't want to be rash and we don't want to be a coward, so bravery is just somewhere in between those, or is it a specific point? And he's going to say it's a specific point, but then the argument becomes, does he give us any way to figure out what that specific point would be? And there are going to be plenty of scholars who say that he doesn't. And then someone like Kraut will say, no, he does. You just have to understand what he's doing in book six. Hmm. And I realize that this is the second episode in a row where I've hinted at the complexities of book six. It might even be the third in a row. And we're far from getting there. But we're
almost there. So next time you can say it again, and then we'll get to book six.
What do you mean? No, we're near book six. We're two.
Oh, I thought you were talking about chapter six. Yes.
Chapter. No, yeah, I'm talking about actual book six.
Oh, the final. Like the, yeah. Uh-huh.
That's where the doctrine of the mean. That book will open, and this is a bit of a preview, I guess. That book will open by him saying, "All right, I've given you this doctrine of the mean, but it's not very useful yet because it's too fuzzy. So how can we fix that?" And then there are certain scholars that say, "Well, he doesn't really fix it. He kind of just goes on to something else." And then Kraut and other will say, no, actually he does refine it. You just have to understand what he's up to. Hmm. So, all right, let's call it there for now, I think.
Yeah, sounds good.